This is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this is the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. It is November 2020. We are back in a COVID pandemic. America is in the worst state it's been. Ryan has escaped. Ryan, how are things going over there in New Zealand?
It's not too bad. It's a beautiful spring day. Here we are down here in the Southern Hemisphere. Everything is very strange. Christmas doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
It's Thanksgiving week coming up. It doesn't feel like Thanksgiving week. We don't have Thanksgiving as a holiday down here, obviously.
It is. Why don't we hop right in talking about a sensitive subject? Don't you have an article on high sensitive troponins?
Yes. I hope it's not a sensitive subject these days, considering it's been around for like a decade in Europe. So in theory, we shouldn't really be doing these high sensitive troponin assays articles still here in 2020. But here we are. So this is called Diagnostic Reclassification by a High Sensitive Cardiac Troponin Assay. And our lead author here is Bern Muma, and they are at the University of California at Davis. And this is a pretty straightforward observational study looking at the impact of rolling out a highly sensitive troponin assay at the UC Davis health system. Basically, it's a before and after study, but while the test was being rolled out, the lab held on to two samples in order to run a conventional troponin TNI and a high sensitivity troponin TNT on each. Their primary outcome is diagnostic reclassification, basically picking up an acute MI when there wasn't an MI before, or reclassifying something as a myocardial injury instead of just an acute MI. Two clinicians review the troponin measurements in context retrospectively to make this determination of reclassification. Also, a secondary outcome of using gender-specific cutoffs within high-sensitivity troponin T for an additional reclassification was examined. As you know, women have smaller myocardial mass, so in theory, they should have a lower cutoff for cardiac troponin, whereas men who have a higher myocardial mass. So if you're detecting different levels of circulating troponin T, there's been some research to show that women should have a more sensitive or a lower threshold for identifying a myocardial infarction. And then they looked at also downstream resource utilization, cardiac stress testing within 30 days, admission, cardiac catheterization, and coronary revascularization. So there are 1,016 patients spread across their study with a variety of single or serial measurements, depending on the algorithm used. But a long story made short, really not much changed. There were a few patients who received initial diagnoses of type 1 and type 2 NSTEMI who were reclassified as no infarction, while one who went the other way. So given the methods, this is basically a wash. From a myocardial injury standpoint versus infarction, a few percent saw a reclassification, meaning they picked up a few patients with quote-unquote myocardial injury that they had previously missed because of the lower sensitivity of the conventional troponin. This has some implications for additional detection of underlying cardiac disease, as opposed to potentially missing these. Not relevant specifically to an acute care setting like the emergency department, where we're mostly interested in an acute coronary syndrome. The effect was further pronounced when gender-specific cutoffs were used, and about as many men were reclassified as no injury as women were to having some injury. Finally, similar numbers of patients received downstream investigations or interventions, which is a minor victory in itself. We have talked many times over the past decade about the potential for these highly sensitive troponins to pick up quote-unquote positive, you know, above the threshold numbers that would lead to additional investigations, which would lead to additional interventions of unclear value. But at least generally speaking, the effect size observed here is small. Regardless, this is just one center, and it doesn't necessarily reflect practice everywhere, but as far as a high sensitivity troponin change goes, we certainly didn't see evidence of harms or unintended consequences in this rollout. So, good work.
I think I've obviously made my opinion clear on high sensitivity troponins over our years on this podcast. But being someone who is currently experiencing the transition from our standard troponin to our high sensitivity, I will tell you the pain that is experienced with this new troponin is quite hard to capture from data sets like this. Now, I find this a little disingenuous, right? Like, because, you know, the way they classify MI versus type 2 injury, when you boil down to it, people, more patients in the high sensitivity troponin group had positive troponins that someone had to figure out what to do with, right? And now seemingly they made the right decisions here, but it doesn't appear that they caught anyone else that needed something, right? The advantage of a high sensitivity troponin is essentially that you have a more sensitive and a more reliable assay. And so one, you can discharge people faster from the emergency department. And two, you're going to pick up more people with MIs, which didn't seem to be the case on either of those things. And so you, from my perspective, seemingly created a more complicated assay because it had more positive findings that you had to then classify and figure out what to do with, all for what I can tell is no real meaningful benefit. So, I mean, it's nice to see that there wasn't a huge amount of increased downstream testing in procedures in this small data set, but it's hard to know what the overall effect this is going to be as we transition in the United States.
So I don't mind the fact that people have to think about additional information in their evaluation of a patient. I mean, we're doctors. We're supposed to incorporate additional information and use it correctly. It's okay to think about whether this patient is having an acute coronary syndrome when the troponin is above the threshold. And you can make an intelligent decision to say, this patient is not having an acute coronary syndrome. This is myocardial injury. This is a demand ischemia. This is some other reason. But it does tell you that the patient doesn't have the world's greatest cardiac function. And if those patients aren't on a beta blocker, aren't in an ACE inhibitor, or some other protective agent, there may be some benefit down the road to having that additional information. It's the invasive interventions that we worry about, that people are just, you know, consult cardiology, let's fire up the cath lab, let's, you know, do an extra stress test, let's do a CT coronary angiogram, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the big things that I think I worry about. And then, you know, you do have that advantage of, if there's a 0 hour troponin that's undetectable, they're just done. But you don't have to do any delta troponins. You don't have to worry about any of the most of the algorithms just say, if you have an undetectable troponin at 0 hours, the patient is done for their acute coronary syndrome rule out.
I would just add, most of the patients that have a 0 hour troponin are ones that I could have been done with a standard troponin as well. Just experiencing this now, I find there's so many more patients that I would do a single troponin on a traditional troponin and be done with, and they'd be going home, that I now have to trend my troponins because they're in that no man's land of troponin purgatory where they have to stay with me for longer. And the other point I'm just going to push back on, that's like one of the, you know, the holy grail, like, advantages of high sensitive troponin that everyone talks about. There's no data that's true that, you know, these people with small troponin leaks would benefit from more aggressive medical management. We have no idea. And whether the troponin is a better identifier than simply just standard history and risk factors, and patients that meet the criteria for starting a beta blocker or aspirin based on their risk factors should be started on them. Whether troponin adds anything to that, I think we have to do a lot of data before, or a lot of studies before actually saying that.
You mean you would trust a patient's history and physical and risk factors and a bunch of other nebulous things over an objective data point like a troponin?
God forbid.
Yeah, no, this study specifically does not look at throughput through the emergency department. It just looks at downstream testing and reclassification. So those issues that you talk about anecdotally about, you know, you have a detectable troponin and now they fall into that intermediate zone of the, you know, the algorithm where you have to do a 1 or a 2 or a 3 hour delta depending on your local practice. It doesn't capture those. It doesn't capture the people for immediate discharge. It doesn't capture the new ones that you would have to do a delta on. And it doesn't capture the quote unquote intermediate, because we covered this last month or 2 months ago, that when you do put these people into the high US study, there's a whole chunk of patients for their algorithm that just after you've spent 3 hours looking at them in the emergency department, done a delta troponin, you still don't have the answer. And 9%+ of them go on to have an actual acute MI.
And if you look at every study that compares, you know, the performance of an algorithm using a high sensitivity versus a standard pathway, the standard pathway is usually a heart score or something, right? And if you decide you can only send heart scores of 1, 2, or 3 home, then you're going to send about 30% of patients home, give or take a small amount. And yes, the high sensitivity troponin will probably allow you to send a few more patients home than 30%, because 30% really isn't that much. But the bulk of the rest of the patients you're admitting to the hospital are just fine. And there's a growing data set coming out now that you can probably send heart scores of 4, 5, and 6 home as long as their EKG is fine and their standard troponin is negative and there are no bad outcomes. And if you compare it to that kind of algorithm, which discharges about 75% of patients, and I don't think the high sensitivity troponin buys you anything except for a way more complicated algorithm that potentially admits more patients.
Are you referring to this growing data set that includes the article that you recently published?
Maybe.
Oh, also Kaiser Permanente, Southern California, published a similar Santa set. And, you know, in my experience at Kaiser Northwest and in Kaiser Southern California, they send about 70-odd% of their patients home. So, yeah, it can be done, and it can be done safely.
Yeah.
Okay, enough time on this cardiac troponin assay. There is a whole podcast left of things to do, including this heart pathway implementation one for you.
Yeah. All right. So our next article, heart pathway implementation safely reduces hospitalizations at 1 year in patients with acute chest pain. And the lead author is Jason Stopra. So this was a pre-planned analysis of a heart pathway, which was a prospective pre-post implementation of the heart score and a pathway for discharging these patients that was conducted in three hospitals. And they enrolled adult patients who were being evaluated for possible ACS without any ST segment changes on their initial EKG. Patients who were enrolled prior to the implementation of the heart pathway underwent a workup as per the treating clinician. Following the implementation of the heart pathway, the clinicians had support of an accelerated diagnostic protocol, which was fully integrated into their EHR. This was essentially an automatic pop-up that triggered for any patient who had a troponin ordered. The pop-up took clinicians through the heart score, and like we just talked about, for patients with a score greater than 4, admission was recommended. Otherwise, if the patient had elevated troponin, known coronary artery disease, ischemic EKG changes, they were also classified as non-low risk and recommended admission for further testing. Patients with scores less than 3 without any elevated troponin were classified as low risk and could be discharged from the ED without any testing. There was a total of 8,474 patients during the study. About 4,700 were in the post-implementation period. Of these, the heart pathway identified approximately 30% of patients as low risk. Like we talked about, most studies, this is the case. It's around 30%. And of these low-risk patients, 2.5% were dead or had an MI in 1 year. 1.7% of these patients died within 1 year, and the remainder experienced an MI. The rates of death and myocardial infarction at 1 year, including the index visit, were similar in the pre- and post-implementation period, 11.6 versus 12.4%. Which is interesting because about 7% less patients were admitted to the hospital and 3.6% less patients received non-invasive testing in the post-implementation period, which of course makes you wonder if admission or non-invasive testing helps at all. So all in all, it's a fairly well-done study that's pretty consistent with most of the data on heart score pathways that has been there previously. And like we talked about before, the big issue here, like with most of the heart scores, is using a heart score of 3 or less will only get you about 30% of patients who are available for discharge, where you have another 70% of patients that you have to admit to the hospital, and very few of them actually have a bad event. So unless you have EKG changes or troponin findings, most of these patients are fairly low risk, and you could probably even get a bigger slice of the pie if you were able to discharge more of these patients.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically now it's 2020, and we've gone 20 years since the sort of the move in emergency medicine to admit literally everybody with chest pain to the hospital because some of those patients would go home and drop dead. Well, some do, but there's no clear protective effect of putting people in the hospital or doing specific non-invasive tests on the general population of patients who come in with chest pain. There is some specific subset of higher risk patients who may benefit from additional evaluation and some acute or urgent intervention. But these kinds of studies look at that general population, the routine, you know, hypertensives, the diabetics, the middle-aged population, the ones that sort of the bread and butter of emergency medicine, who don't have 6 stents and, you know, aren't coming in after, you know, taking 7 doses of nitro to get pain-free. Those patients are not included in these data sets. And it just shows that we don't need to hospitalize these people or refer them for urgent cardiac testing. And this is just one more piece of information that shows that fewer tests and fewer follow-up interventions is not having a different change in their long-term outcomes, like at 1 year.
Yeah. Now, just the vast majority of the patients that need reasonably quick testing and intervention are identified by your EKG and your troponin. And when those two are negative, the most of these patients are not going to have a bad outcome.
Yeah. And it's basically what we've talked about. Doctors have the cognitive ability to interpret a history, a physical, and put it all into context and say, this patient is actually at high risk for a short-term bad outcome. I don't need data and, you know, I don't need to put them into a heart score to tell me this. The patients who we don't think are having a bad outcome are probably going to be fine. Yeah. Imagine that.
So you're saying we don't need a complex decision rule or a high sensitivity troponin to make these decisions?
Just like we did before we had all these things. We muddled along somehow. and there weren't just bodies in the streets. And that concludes the chest pain portion of the podcast. Moving on to, this is called Medication Education for Dosing Safety, a randomized controlled trial. Lead author here is Caitlin Narekis-Lee, and they are at Boston Children's Hospital. And this looks at a pretty simple, straightforward topic that has good face validity, that dosing medications for kids is relatively more different than for adults. You know, it's not a onerous, like, you know, cognitively burdensome task, but it's a multiple step process to do correctly. And the smaller the child, the more profound the effect of any dosing error. And we also expect parents with all levels of health literacy and intellectual ability to interpret our discharge instructions and medication dosing instructions. And this trial basically expressly addresses that sort of discharge instruction and education that parents get. And they do it by implementing a specific teaching intervention at discharge for patients who are being instructed to give their children a specific weight-based dose of ibuprofen or acetaminophen. And the comparator for this specific, intensive, individualized teaching was, well, usual care, which is to say nothing. So when they enroll 149 patients and lose a third to follow-up, and of the ones they were able to reach, a larger percentage of them were able to tell investigators over the phone the correct dose for their child, it's probably reflects a true finding. The fact that they spent time with these patients and actually had like a little pre-labeled syringe, and they, you know, wrote down their specific explicit weight-based dosing for the children and compared it to not specifically or explicitly doing any teaching, it's not a surprising outcome. And it's, you know, there is an improvement, and it's not the most reliable or precise measurement of the effect size. And there's almost certainly a Hawthorne effect related to the study intervention because they're focusing on it. And if you were to go ahead and implement this in your own practice, you know, the effectiveness would probably tail off over time as it became routine and people spent less and less time on it. But there is no specific reason to believe this is a bad thing to do. It is absolutely a good thing to do. And they've proven that it's a good thing to do in comparison to the nebulous usual care that they have. We obviously can do better at providing clear instructions to parents when their children are being discharged from the emergency department. Their specific intervention is not necessarily the optimal intervention, but it is certainly superior to whatever they were doing before.
Yeah, I think it's not surprising when you spend more time with someone teaching them the proper dose and they'll more often get it right. Of note, most of the mistakes were underdosing patients rather than overdosing them. Is this the best way to do it? I don't know. Maybe it's better if you had like special syringes that were only to the right size of the patient, right? So you could only give 4 cc's or something like that. It wouldn't be that hard to make these kind of individual syringes given there's a limited amount of dosing that you would give someone, right? You know, it would probably be 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, and that's about it, right? And if you just gave them the syringe that could only give the patient the right dose, then nobody would make a mistake, right? And that might be a simple way of doing this as well. But certainly, the more time you spend with the patient explaining how to dose the medication, the more often they will be able to report it back to you a day or two later.
And of course, not to minimize the importance of giving the correct dose of medication, but we also don't find ourselves staffing pediatric emergency departments filled with acetaminophen and ibuprofen overdoses. So the actual difference between this patient, the parents being able to tell you the correct dose versus giving a therapeutic dose to the child versus actually causing harm to the child in some way, fashion or another is a big stretch. But absolutely, for certain high-risk medications, it's a big deal. This is something you could potentially generalize to those higher-risk medications. You should definitely be using some really good explicit discharge instructions and measurements and, you know, documentation that if you're discharging a patient with a very high risk medication that has a low, you know, a specific therapeutic index or, you know, overdose potential. And this is potentially generalizable to that. But, you know, even though these two medications aren't necessarily the, you know, examples of ones that are going to be harming children.
Right. Exactly. All right, let's move on. So our next paper is an analysis of the changes in emergency department visits after a state declaration during the time of COVID, and the lead author is Bjorn Westgaard. So I think all of us who experienced the COVID surge, which in the U.S. is pretty much everyone at this point, have noticed that all your other ED patients seem to disappear. So the question is, where did they all go? What happened to them? So these authors did an observational study of visits to the emergency department at a level one trauma center in St. Paul, Minnesota, from the period of 28 days before through 28 days after their state of emergency declaration, which was March 13th, 2020. They examined the cross-sectional visits from February 15th to April 20th and used a historical comparison for the same dates in the year 2019. Essentially, they looked at the number of visits and the diagnosis codes for those visits. After the state of declaration, the ED experienced a gradual but significant decline in the average visits from 250 daily at 28 days before the state the declaration to 167 visits at 28 days after the declaration. This represented a 7.7% weekly decline in ED visits and a 49.3% decline overall. They also noted there was a 35.2% decline from the visits that occurred in 2019. There was a significantly disproportionate decline in ED visits from younger patients, from those older than 65, for patients who are white or Asian, and patients with Medicare and other insurances, as well as patients who were ambulatory on arrival. As far as ED diagnosis, there was a significant decrease in diagnosis such as syncope, CVA, abdominal pain, urolithiasis, and back pain. They also saw a significant increase in the proportion of patients presenting with upper respiratory infections, shortness of breath, and chest pain. Though of note, this was not because of an increase in the actual representation of COVID patients, as the amount of patients who had COVID during this period was 0.4%. So likely this was more patients just concerned of having COVID and coming to the ED with these symptoms. You know, this is all in all a pretty interesting paper, and it's interesting because I often assume that the change in patient load who are coming to our emergency department during the surge of COVID was due to COVID itself. But at least from this paper, it seemed to be more due to the declaration, because none of these patients actually presented with COVID during this time. And so it seems that more patients were staying home and not coming to the ED simply because there was a declaration order in place. So it'd be really interesting to see, looking at different areas of the country when the declaration came in versus when the actual surge of COVID patients came in, how that affected your ED cohort of patients, because sure, it would change it in different ways.
Well, and of course, we're going to see that there's shelter-in-place orders for certain states for a second time now. So you actually have multiple sort of time points of measurement and seeing whether that's an effect of increasing COVID prevalence in the community, because in April, you know, some places had some COVID coming on, but not the way that it is here in October and November. And then sometimes some of the stay-at-home orders were almost proactive as opposed to reactive back in April and May, as opposed to the current ones, which are certainly reactive and not proactive at this point for most places. You know, trying to flatten the curve, trying to save the hospital system, whereas most places in the United States back in April were getting ahead of it as a response to what they saw in New York City and other places around the world, and trying to be proactive and preventing it from getting out of control. So yeah, and I think we've all lived through this in some fashion or another, and we've seen reductions, and then we've seen the increased patient volumes again. And you know, there's going to be a lot of interesting papers like this over the next year, kind of analyzing the patterns and then trying to figure out where all these people went. Appendicitis, you know, certain things that, what is it about, you know, leaving the home that makes you prone to stroke? Or did these people just complete their strokes at home? You know, appendicitis, is there some sort of environmental variable about getting around it? Potentially, you know, there could be an infectious viral component to appendicitis, where there's, you know, localized inflammatory swelling of your gastrointestinal tract. All these sorts of different, you know, underlying theories of pathophysiology of disease. Heart attacks, they're staying home, clearly. Or are we overdiagnosing them? That's the question. Are we overdiagnosing a bunch of heart attacks and labeling a bunch of people with chest pain as NSTEMIs? Or did only the true NSTEMIs come in, whereas everybody else stayed home? Or, I mean, syncope, though, obviously. Like, everybody with syncope just stayed home. That's my favorite one. It's like, yeah, I'm probably fine. And that's true. You probably are.
Right. I think that's the big question, right? Stroke, what happened to them?
So yeah, it's an interesting distribution to see, and this is one of the debates over, you know, are we harming more of the population by these stay home orders and the delaying their care, or, you know, having delays to treatment of needed necessary care? And that's one of the ongoing debates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. Like, so much of what we see in the ED doesn't actually require emergent care, and the art of emergency medicine is identifying the few patients with an actual emergency diagnosis within all these other patients who are going to be okay. And so maybe all we're seeing is that the true disease come in, but it's such a small rate compared to the actual other patients who end up staying home. And then the question is, are the patients with true disease presenting later, and are they harmed by these delays? And that kind of data we just don't have yet.
Yeah, and then this is going to play into sort of that quote unquote excess deaths calculation. When you look at the state like New York City back in April, there were true excess deaths because hospital capacity was maxed out and they didn't have the ability to treat those patients. if you look at these data from St. Paul, where the hospitals are clearly not maxed out, and you say, well, there's excess deaths during this time period, that may be attributable to the stay-at-home order and the people who are avoiding their necessary care. And then we're going to find the delays in potentially elective or semi-urgent surgeries may have downstream health consequences. We just don't know yet.
A lot of work to do.
Yes, more studies. PhDs to be minted. All right. This is somewhat timely here for another COVID-19 times is this next article called Telemedicine Facilitation of Transfer Coordination from Emergency Departments. Lead author here is Emily M. Hayden, and they are at Massachusetts General Hospital. And this is a very short, brief report about the use in telemedicine in emergency departments, in case you were curious how people are using telemedicine. And the answer is not very many.
Not very much.
Which, it's a little hard to say precisely because some patients, it depends on their definition of telemedicine to some extent too. But specifically, it's a brief report from the approximately 5% of United States emergency departments who reported using telemedicine. And it's mostly a descriptive study about its use. And as you could tell from that title, about half of those emergency departments use telemedicine for transfer coordination. And it's actually mostly the emergency departments you'd expect, those ones with fewer than 10,000 annual visits, the little tiny emergency departments who just don't have all the various resources and they need remote assistance for coordinating transfer or supporting the transfer. And you know, the vast majority of those emergency departments do not have a physician continuously staffing the department, and that telemedicine is also used to oversee physician assistants or nurse practitioners, and as well as to provide access to consultant services. Then they also identified that there's another portion of emergency departments, included in this report, that use the telemedicine primarily in support of a busier emergency department with continuous physician coverage and primarily to provide access to consultant services. As you might expect, most of these consultant services, as you've probably heard from other literature, is stroke neurology, probably being the most common one. But also, interestingly, so pediatrics, telepsychiatry, they mentioned teletrauma. I'm not sure about that one. I haven't seen or heard about that one. Teledermatology. And then teleradiology. I mean, I don't know if you have, I'm not sure about teleradiology, but certainly, you know, remote radiology support services are a thing. And so if you're interested in learning a little bit more of the state of things in telemedicine in the emergency department, you could read this article. But it's almost certainly dramatically changed this year as everything has gone online and so many different things have been tried to be done virtually that there's so much more infrastructure for telemedicine now that I expect when they do this same study in a couple of years, it's going to be vastly different.
Yeah, I mean, I think this study shows you just simply the rate that it's not being used and the potentials for telemedicine are vast. But other than that, you can't really tell much more from this data set.
Yes, it's very brief. It's a brief research report.
So our next paper is Trends in Diagnostic Point-of-Care Ultrasound Reimbursement for Medicare Beneficiaries Among the U.S. Emergency Medicine Workforce 2012 to 2016. And the lead author is Madeline S. Birch. So the use of point-of-care ultrasound in the practice of emergency medicine has grown tremendously over the past decade. But what about the rates of reimbursement for this diagnostic modality? Previous data suggests that prior to 2012, the rates of reimbursement were very low. And so these authors wanted to see what happened over the subsequent 8 years. And they conducted a cross-sectional study using the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services fee-for-service provider utilization and payment data set from 2012 to 2016. They identified emergency medicine workforce clinicians that met two criteria. One, receipt of at least 11 of any of the emergency medicine context-specific evaluation and management claims. So were you billing for emergency medicine visits? And you also had to have one of the six pre-specified emergency medicine clinician types, which were emergency medicine physician, family practice physician, internal medicine physician, critical care physician, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. POCUS studies were identified using codes associated with reimbursement, specifically the 21 reimbursable point-of-care ultrasound studies identified by the 2018 ACIP coding and reimbursement guidelines. So from 2012 to 2016, a total of 77,685,000 distinct emergency medicine clinicians were identified. Overall, the number of emergency medicine clinicians increased over the subsequent years. In 2012, it was a little over 51,000, and in 2016, it went all the way up to 60,390. Over this time period, the proportion of clinicians receiving reimbursement for POCUS also increased. The only problem is it went from extremely low to really low. So in 2012, it was less than 1%, 0.7%, and it went all the way up to 1.3% in 2016. There was also a change in the types of studies that were reimbursed over this time period, with a decrease in the number of DVTs and retroperitoneal studies and an increase in the number of limited echoes, which probably represents a change in the skill set of emergency physicians over this time. Now, this data set probably doesn't capture all of ultrasound billing, but it's safe to say that their numbers, while not exact, likely represent the reality of what's going on in the United States, at least in 2016. And that is that while ultrasound is being used a lot more, billing for these studies is not done with any regularity. And that probably represents the fact that it takes formidable infrastructure to actually capture these images, review them, and then bill for them. And this type of infrastructure is just not available for most emergency.
Well, I mean, I think it's not even as interesting, like the sheer numbers, but the sheer numbers of clinicians doing them, especially when you look at their like reimbursement patterns in table two. It's like, yeah, there was one guy in 2012 who did 18 genital exams. And then there were a few years where nobody did anything. And then there's one guy in 2016 who did 14 of them. You know, there's really only a really small subset of clinicians doing these exams, let alone the sheer volume of the exam. So even if the quality assurance infrastructure is getting built up and the image storage infrastructure is getting built up, I think that probably mostly just enables a few clinicians to do a lot more rather than more clinicians to do a whole bunch of new exams. So yeah, the workforce is changing and it's 2020, and this is a snapshot back to 2016. So it'd be really interesting to see the last 4 years of data added on to this to see, because I know that people have done a lot more building those QI and QA infrastructures for storing images and reviewing images and doing peer review on images that you really need to have if you're going to have a department that does point of care ultrasound and formally bills for it and so on and so forth.
Now that ultrasound fellowship is a GME sponsored fellowship, a lot of that fellowship is actually training physicians to build these systems as far as billing and reviewing images. So it will be interesting to see how this changes over the subsequent years and how more clinicians actually complete that fellowship.
Exactly. All right. So speaking of billing, the next article in this issue was Medicare reimbursement to physicians decreased for common emergency medicine services from 2000 to 2020. The lead author here is Jordan Pollack, and they're at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine in Scottsdale, one of the two sunny versions of the Mayo Clinic. So another very brief report. Title basically says it all. This team pretty much just looked up CPT codes and physician fee schedules from the lookup tool from the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services from 2000 and 2020 and converted them to inflation-adjusted dollars. And what can only be described as predictable results, at least from the title, obviously, medical reimbursement declined by an average of 29% for these CPT codes over the time period, these 20 most common care codes. The actual amount reimbursed did not decrease specifically for each of the CPT codes examined, but once adjusted for consumer price index for urban consumers, the overall loss emerged. This reflects Medicare reimbursement only, and which is of course a substantial portion of our emergency department visits, but it also doesn't reflect private payer reimbursement. So that's the little brief report. There's an editorial by Arjun Venkatesh that puts these data into context, noting the average emergency physician salary has actually increased from $240,000 a year to $350,000 a year over the same time frame, and describes the complexities of the overall payment structure. How are we getting paid more if payments are decreasing? His team's editorial looks at the relative frequency of these top CPT codes, noting dramatic reductions in, say, level one emergency department visits and corresponding increases in level five and level four evaluations, visits whose absolute difference in total payment far exceeds the decreases in relative compensation for each visit. So we may be getting paid less on a CPT level, but you also have to remember that it's also tied into these CPTs represent relative value units, and the relative value units are changing as well. So there's a very complex system that is broken down very nicely by Arjun in his editorial. And it turns out we're probably either one, working harder, which is possible, and then we're also just potentially just are capturing the payment for our services rendered. So it's probably a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. But to just say that reimbursement has decreased for common services, it's true, but it doesn't capture the whole picture.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think mostly this just kind of demonstrates the complexity of billing in the emergency department in the United States currently. But you know, we're making up quantity instead of quality, it seems like.
We won't describe how bizarre American healthcare system is, but that it even has to even worry about these complexities of specific CPT codes and reimbursement changes and RVUs and so on and so forth to document the billing in our for-profit healthcare system. Clearly, we don't have to worry about that in New Zealand.
No, you have nothing to worry about anymore. All right, well, why don't we move on? Our next article is ondansetron prescription is associated with a reduced return visit to the pediatric emergency department for children with gastroenteritis. And the lead author is Doreen Benery. So all of us that work in the emergency department or just have children realize that it's not uncommon for them to vomit. And one of the mainstays for treatment in ED or acute gastroenteritis is ondansetron. And while there is data suggesting that the use of ondansetron in the ED reduces admissions, the benefits of sending a child home with a prescription for ondansetron is less clear. So these authors conducted a retrospective cohort study of pediatric patients who presented to a large urban tertiary care pediatric ED or its 11 affiliated urgent care centers during a five-year period between 2012 and 2017. They used ICD codes to identify children with acute gastroenteritis. Patients were eligible if they were between 6 months and 18 years of age and were discharged following their ED or urgent care visit. They included a little over 82,000 patients. Most of the index visits were seen in the emergency department, and 22.3% were treated by a pediatric emergency trained physician. An ondansetron prescription was only given to 13.4% of the patients. Right off the bat, there were significant differences in the patients who did and didn't receive ondansetron. Patients who received the prescription were older than those who did not. Medicaid-insured Black and non-Hispanic patients were less likely to receive an ondansetron prescription. They also tried to control for these imbalances using a regression model and found that receiving an ondansetron prescription remained significantly associated with the primary outcome, which was a reduction in the 72-hour return rate. They also found that patients who were younger in age who received IV fluid were being treated by a pediatric EM-trained physician, had been given ondansetron in the ED, or had a radiological study during their visit were associated with an increased risk of a repeat ED visit. Is it important to note that there did not appear to be an increased rate of missed serious pathology in children who were given ondansetron as a prescription. So it didn't seem that these prescriptions masked kids with appendicitis or anything like that. So I think this is a tremendous effort. Given the limitations of the study, it's hard to know exactly what to do with this data. As noted, this was not a randomized controlled trial, and there was huge differences in the groups, and so the potential for confounding is fairly big. There's obviously some reasons why some kids got ondansetron and some kids didn't. Additionally, the children didn't have to go back to this emergency department or these urgent care systems and may have presented somewhere else and been missed by this data set. Is an ondansetron prescription helpful? I'm not really sure. I don't think this study actually gets us much closer to knowing. My practice has been to give children who I've given ondansetron in the ED a prescription for it to go home. But honestly, you know, looking at some of the studies we've reviewed over the past few years on the Annals podcast, we may be better off just prescribing them alcohol pads to sniff.
I was about to say, just prescribing them alcohol pads to sniff. Got to make sure that you qualify that appropriately. Ondansetron is at least mostly harmless, I think, from a toxic standpoint. Is it super helpful when we discharge patients? We've seen a whole bunch of different data come out of different studies, some of which say that doesn't really change the revisit rate, some of which doesn't change the subsequent readmission rate, and then some like this that maybe provide some clues that in a nebulous fashion that it certainly doesn't hurt, you know, maybe even helpful as far as readmission, but this data isn't conclusive one way or the other. As far as, you know, the adverse events, the, you know, masking of a more serious underlying diagnosis, I don't think ondansetron is strong enough to do that. First of all, I don't think it actually has a significant enough clinical effect to mask appendicitis or another more serious diagnosis. And then, like you said, that we just don't have 100%, we just don't have a reliable estimate or a reliable way of measuring the revisit rates of these patients to really trust that outcome. And the confidence intervals are super wide, so we don't have a precise measurement. We just don't know. If your practice has been to prescribe ondansetron, it's okay. If your practice has been to not prescribe ondansetron, it's okay. That is my summary of ondansetron in pediatric gastroenteritis. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay either way. You're not hurting anybody. You're not missing an opportunity, conclusive, reliable opportunity to help a patient by prescribing it or not prescribing it.
This study certainly doesn't say one way or another.
Yes. And then the last one here, I'll try and be quick because it's a complicated one that doesn't lend itself well to podcasting. The effect of operational stressors on emergency department clinical scheduling and patient throughput. Lead author here is Jesse M. Pines, and he's with U.S. Acute Care Solutions. And this last article tries to describe the physician work environment and try and relate the variables observed in the physician work environment to patient throughput. And by work environment, these authors try to come up with this sort of descriptive variable for stress by relating to triage category, age, critical care time, and other documented signs of potentially high-intensity patient requirements. Then they try to calculate the relative staffing of emergency departments by looking at the number of physicians on service and the number of advanced practice providers, with advanced practice providers counting as a half physician. And then they look at emergency department departures per hour per clinician, and likewise try to relate these to their descriptive measures of intensity. So I think in simplified language, the best way to describe this article is, when the patients get sicker, does throughput suffer? And in this study, they applied these rules to 350,000 shift periods and 14 million patient departures across 359 facility years across 110 emergency departments. And their analyses are reliable. The answer is no. The descriptive characteristics seem to indicate, as we can probably all perceive, an aging, more ill population is visiting our emergency departments. But despite this, the number of patient departures per hour is still creeping up across all shifts, regardless. We are charitably adapting by shouldering increased cognitive burden and patient loads, it would appear. There is a lot of data and inferences made based on complicated foundational assumptions. Again, far more than we could concisely distill on a podcast. So if you are interested in this topic, I suggest you check out the article yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fairly complex analysis that makes a lot of assumptions. And it's also, you know, it's pretty blunt data, right? There's so many more specific things that's really hard to look at in large data sets like this. And it's not hard to imagine that complexity of the patients alone, the staffing or workforce alone, are the big markers on ED throughput. You know, I think more is the inefficiencies of the system that are much harder to identify, right? How many buttons do you have to click to discharge a person? How many people do you have to call to admit a person? All those kind of things. How many tasks are interrupted during your ED shift because of all the various other things that you have to do that get put on you as the clinician? These are much harder to capture and probably play a large role in ED throughput and clinicians' stress load, or whatever we're calling it, operational stressors.
Yeah. So even if they had shown a decreased throughput, at least as far as their measurement has been per clinician per hour, then you couldn't necessarily chalk it up to the patient characteristics. You would have to say there's hospital level characteristics could be changing as well. So the fact that they at least don't see that, they still see increased throughput, it also depends so much on what exactly that means. Again, if you're interested in this topic, there's a lot of data to page through. We're not going to get into it. Check out the article yourself.
I think the most obvious answer here that it probably is reliable is Mondays were the worst, as they always are.
Yes. Mondays are bad.
Which anyone who works in the emergency department already knows.
All the strokes and appendicitis, just wait till Monday. See, that kind of ties back to our, like, you know, delayed care and COVID article. It's like, why are Mondays so bad? You know, it's not because of, is it because of the COVID? Is it because there was a shelter in place order over the weekend and they all put off their care? I mean, it's you know, yeah, I mean, basically, yes. Yeah, it's just interesting.
All right. Well, that wraps us up for another month. As always, any questions, comments, or concerns, we can be reached at annalsaudio@acep.org. Otherwise, this was Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki. This was the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. So long.